What would you do to save your life? What would you be willing to give up in order to save your life? In the spring of 2003, a man named Aaron Ralston, an experienced woodsman, was hiking in a remote area of Utah, and he made a serious mistake. He didn't tell anyone where he was going, though he was hiking alone. While he was out, he dislodged a very large boulder that rolled over and fell on his right hand and his right forearm, and he could not move the boulder. He could not extract his hand. He was alone. No one knew where he was. He was able to use his left hand to eat the food he had with him, to drink the water he had with him, but after 5 days, and no one had found him, the water was gone. Food was gone. And he realized he was not going to get out of this situation except through one means. And that was to use his multi-tool to cut off his arm, which he did. And he hiked out 13 miles and saved his life by cutting off his arm. When we see that our lives are on the line, we will go to extreme lengths to save them. There, time and time again, people have performed extraordinary feats when they come to the point where that's the only way to save their lives or the only way to save the life of someone that they love. And yet, as we are reminded almost daily through events such as the Haiti earthquake, your life hangs by a thread. And that thread can be cut in an instant, and your life will be over. Time and time again, Scripture emphasizes that God is the one who gives life, and God is the one who keeps us alive, and God is the one who can end our lives at any moment. He is the source of all life, and He determines the end of life. We read in Acts 17, God Himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. Indeed, He determines the length of your life in this age, and He determines whether or not you will be with Him in the age to come, in eternity. And we read of Jesus' words in John 5. The Father raises the dead and gives them life. The Son gives life to whom He will. And He makes this promise, truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears My words, says Jesus, and believes in Him who sent Me, has eternal life. He does not come into judgment. He has passed from death to life. God is the giver of life, and God is the taker of life. How do you respond to such a God? In this passage of Exodus that we've been working our way through, we've seen God send plague after plague after plague on the Egyptians, increasing severity of plagues, emphasizing His sovereign control, His sovereign power. This is now the third sermon on the plagues, and we've now seen the overall theme. God is the great King. He is in charge of all things, from mosquitoes to frogs to life and death. His glory must be revealed. He is sovereign even over the hearts of His enemies, as we saw last week. Here, in this final tenth plague is a fulfillment of all that God has prophesied against Egypt. God displays his sovereignty as Pharaoh at long last capitulates to his demands. And he shows that he is sovereign over life and death. He decides who lives and who dies and when that death takes place. He is sovereign over every womb. All the firstborn, this passage tells us, belong to him. Those who oppose him lose everything, and those who trust him, he provides for their every need. So the bottom line for each of us here today is, will we trust him? Will we trust the giver of life and live? Or will we reject the giver of life and lose all this good? So I want to preach two sermons this weekend, next week, on this passage, Exodus 11, 1 to 13, 16. Today what I want to do is to go through the story, the narrative, what happens over these chapters, and see God's sovereignty over Pharaoh, his sovereignty over life and death. And then next week, we'll focus on the picture of Jesus that we see in this institution of the Passover. So I'll begin by going through the story, making just a few comments along the way. And then we'll have three headings. God is sovereign over Pharaoh and all gods. God is sovereign over life and death. And then finally, how will you respond? Well, recall that God had prophesied to Moses that he would multiply his signs and wonders and force Pharaoh to let the people go. You may recall that he also prophesied specifically that he would kill Pharaoh's firstborn son. This is back in Exodus 4, 22 and 23. The Lord, or remember, when we see the word Lord in all capital letters, that stands for the name of God, probably pronounced Yahweh. I'll substitute that word for Lord most of the time in my reading today. Exodus 4:22, thus says Yahweh, Israel is my firstborn son. And I say to you, that is to Pharaoh, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, I will kill your firstborn son. Well, that prophecy is fulfilled in today's account. And we see here that many more die in addition to Pharaoh's firstborn son. Exodus 11, verse 1. Yahweh said to Moses, yet one plague more I will bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will drive you away completely. Verse 4. So Moses said to Pharaoh, thus says Yahweh, about midnight I will go out in the midst of Egypt, and every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle. There shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there has never been, nor ever will be again. Those are the words of God to Pharaoh through Moses. Now Moses himself begins to speak. But not a dog shall growl against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, that you, Pharaoh, may know that Yahweh makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And all these, your servants, Pharaoh's servants, shall come down to me, that is Moses, and bow down to me, saying, get out, you and all the people who follow you. And after that, I will go out. And Moses went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Then Yahweh said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, And Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go out of his land. Now, when he says that Pharaoh did not listen, did not let the people go, he meant as a result of this warning. This warning was not sufficient to enforce Pharaoh to let them go. After the deaths of the firstborn, he is going to let them go, as we shall see. Now, that is the end of chapter 11, and we have one of these strange times in the book of Exodus, strange from our point of view. It almost looks like an interlude in the book. We're going to talk about it more next week, but this is not accidental. God has planned this book exactly how he wants it. And what he's saying now at the beginning of chapter 12 is that this event is so important in the history of God's plan of redemption that the entire Jewish calendar needs to be reoriented to put this at the beginning of the year. God is now bringing his people out of slavery. This is the first step towards establishing them in the land. Even more importantly, he is foreshadowing the death of Christ to come thousands of years later. And so he says, this is the beginning of the Jewish year. Chapter 12, verse 1. Yahweh said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his nearest neighbor shall take according to the number of persons. According to what each can eat, you shall make your count for the lamb." And he continues to then give regulations on the slaughter of the Passover lamb and the eating of the lamb that we will look at next week. For now, simply note that the lamb is killed, it is roasted, it is completely eaten, anything that's left over is burned up in the fire, and they are to eat this, not sitting back relaxed in their house clothes, but they're to be dressed and ready to travel. Now note, they're killing this lamb, roasting it and eating it, before the firstborn have died. So Pharaoh has not said yet that they can go. So the very fact that they eat this, dressed, ready to go, everything packed up, is an indication of faith that God is going to do exactly what he prophesied. Verse 12. God is speaking. "For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am Yahweh. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." Verse 21. "Then Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, 'Go and select lambs for yourselves according to your clans and kill the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop,'" that's a plant that has branches that are really close together, so it makes kind of a good paintbrush. "Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood that is in the basin and touch the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. None of you shall go out of the door of his house until the morning. For Yahweh will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, Yahweh will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to strike you." Now notice something interesting here. Previous plagues have indicated that God did not send a plague on the Israelites. Right? He made a distinction between the Egyptians and the Israelites. But here, he does make a distinction. But the distinction is not Israelites, Egyptians. The distinction is who has the blood on the doorposts and who does not. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Verse 28. Then the people of Israel went and did so, as Yahweh had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. At midnight, Yahweh struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. What about the houses of the Israelites? Even there was a death, wasn't there? In every household, there was either the death of a lamb, or there was the death of the firstborn son. A death was required in every household. There was a substitution of the death of the lamb for the death of the son. We'll talk about that more next week. Verse 31. Then Pharaoh summoned, or that word I think should probably be translated, sent word to Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Up, go out from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go, serve Yahweh as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said and be gone. And bless me also." The Egyptians were urgent with the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, "We shall all be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls being bound up in their cloaks on their shoulders. The people of Israel had also done as Moses told them, for they had asked the Egyptians for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. And Yahweh had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have what they asked. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. And the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. Just a brief footnote here. 600,000, if that's the case, 600,000 men ready for a battle, this would be about 2.5 million Israelites. That's possible. It's also possible this word translated thousand is a military term, kind of like brigade would be for us. And it could be that there weren't 1,000 in every brigade. There were 600 brigades. Some have speculated that each brigade might have only been 40 or 50 people, in which case what we'd be talking about is 25 to 30,000 total Israelites instead of 2.5 million. So it's hard to know exactly how many there were. As I continue to preach through Exodus, I'm going to use the traditional interpretation and talk about 2 to 3 million Israelites. But just a note, we don't really know how many there were. However many there were, it was completely miraculous that God brought them out and maintained their lives in the desert for 40 years. Verse 38. A mixed multitude also went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough that they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. The time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, on that very day, that is, on the very day after the night the Lord killed the firstborn, all the hosts of Yahweh went out from the land of Egypt. Look ahead to chapter 13, verse 12. You shall set apart to Yahweh all that first opens the womb. All the firstborn of your animals that are male shall be Yahweh's. Every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And when in time to come your son asks you, "What does this mean?" you shall say to him, "By a strong hand Yahweh brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. For when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, Yahweh killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animals. Therefore, I sacrifice to Yahweh all the males that first opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a mark on your hand or frontlets between your eyes, for by a strong hand Yahweh brought us out of Egypt." Well, that's the story. Now let's look at these themes. God is sovereign over Pharaoh and over all gods. We saw two times ago that God is displaying through each individual plague superiority over the gods of Egypt, one after another. And chapter 12, verse 12 says this explicitly. "On all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am Yahweh." Now, remember how Pharaoh responded the first time Moses and Aaron came to him. In chapter 5, verse 2, they tell him, "Yahweh demands, let my people go." And Pharaoh responded, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, and moreover, I will not let Israel go." At this point, he knows who Yahweh is. He has seen him in plague after plague, and now his own son is dead. God has already told Pharaoh, back in chapter 9, that his political power and indeed his own life are all in God's hands. Remember chapter 9, verses 15 and 16. God tells him, "You exist, Pharaoh, for my purposes. By now I could have put out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. I could have killed you by now. You're only alive today because I have a reason for that. For this purpose I have raised you up, to show you my power, so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth." Now remember, Pharaoh again and again and again and again has tried to bargain with God. Okay, you Israelites can go, but only the men, not the women. And then he said, okay, you can go, but not very far. And then you can go, but only take a few of your livestock. Leave the majority of your livestock here. And now there's no more bargaining. Once Pharaoh's heir is dead, his heir, think about that. Pharaoh is supposed to be a god. His son is supposed to be a god. And he is now dead. So he capitulates. Says, "Go. Do as you have said." But then Pharaoh concludes with this surprising statement. "Bless me also." Pharaoh is asking Moses to bless him. Now, who is superior? The one who gives the blessing or the one who receives the blessing? The one who gives the blessing has something the receiver does not have. Indeed, somewhat different context, Hebrews 7:7 says exactly this. "It is beyond dispute," that verse says, "that the inferior is blessed by the superior." So Pharaoh is saying, in effect, "You, Moses, the spokesman for Yahweh, are superior to me. Yahweh is superior to me, so bless me. My son is dead. My country is ruined." There's a complete capitulation on Pharaoh's part, though, as we shall see, it is a temporary capitulation. We read earlier in Isaiah 45, "To Yahweh shall come and be ashamed all who were incensed against him." That's exactly what happens with Pharaoh, isn't it? He comes and is ashamed. He had been incensed against Yahweh tremendously, but he comes and is ashamed. So God shows himself to be sovereign over the greatest political power of his day, the greatest economic power of his day, the greatest spiritual power that seemed to exist. That was true in the time of Moses. It is still true today. Whatever God pleases, he does. Pharaoh submitted at this point to God's power. He acknowledged that God is the one who's in control. So the question for us is, do we acknowledge the same? Do we see God as more powerful than the mightiest powers in this earth? God sovereign over Pharaoh and all gods. God sovereign over life and death. I want to bring out three subpoints under this heading. First of all, God is sovereign over the beginning of life. God is sovereign over the beginning of life. We read that the firstborn from every womb, livestock or human, belongs to God. That's summarized in Exodus 13, verse 2. God says, consecrate to me all the firstborn. Whatever is the first to open the womb among the people of Israel, both of man and of beast, is mine. Now, does that mean that the firstborn is God's and the second and third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth in our case are not God's? No. The first is a picture of all. So, in the law, when God tells the people, bring of the first fruits of your crop before me, the very first of the harvest is given to God as a picture that it all belongs to God. Just so, when we give of our income to God, we take a portion, as soon as it comes in, we take a portion of that and present it to God as an act of worship. Not to say, this part is God's and everything else is mine, I can do with it whatever I want, but as a picture of saying, all of it belongs to you, O God. And so I'm acknowledging that by giving this portion to you right up front. And that's the picture here. The firstborn is explicitly acknowledged as God's as a picture that all life comes from God. A reminder that no one lives apart from God's grace and bounty. He is the giver of life. And so he sets up a system here where for that firstborn from the womb, in effect, God, by redeeming that firstborn from the womb, you're saying God would be perfectly just to take this child and kill him or her right now. And so I'm acknowledging that by making this sacrifice, redeeming it through a sacrifice right now. The death of another is necessary so that this one may live. So God is sovereign over the beginning of life. Secondly, God is sovereign over the end of life. Now this truth is brought out in an interesting way in this tenth and last plague. In the earlier plagues, remember what happened? You know, Moses raised his staff over the Nile and the waters became blood, right? Okay? Moses raised his staff and other things happened. Or the mosquitoes, the gnats just came all over the land. The frogs just appeared. But nowhere until this point is God said explicitly to come to Egypt himself. Exodus 11, verse 4. Thus says Yahweh, about midnight, I will go out in the midst of Egypt. Chapter 12, verse 29. At midnight, Yahweh struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. God is the one who ends the lives of these Egyptians. Our God reveals himself to us as gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. And he reveals himself to us as one who will by no means clear the guilty. God has no reluctance to execute judgment when the right time comes. The Egyptians must know that He is God and there is no other. All the ends of the earth must know His power, His majesty. He must exalt the glory of His name. And we must see that the life we want so much, the life that we will do so much to try to hold on to, is completely in God's hands. And so He passed through Egypt on that night in a spring more than 3,000 years ago. And He can pass through Charlotte on a late winter or early spring night and take the lives of whoever He wishes. And He would be perfectly just in so doing. He is sovereign over the beginning of life, and He is sovereign over the end of life. There's no other way to read this passage. Third subpoint. God is sovereign over the beginning of life. He's sovereign over the end of life. And God provides a way to save your life. You see that with the firstborn. The redemption of the firstborn. That firstborn child, God could take. He'd have a perfect right to take. All firstborn are going to be consecrated to Me. But He allows them to substitute for the death of the firstborn the death of an animal. He provides a way out, a sacrifice, a substitute. Similarly, with the Passover, as we'll look next week, as we noted, there was a death in every household. Either the firstborn son, either the firstborn, or the death of the lamb. Here we have the blood on the doorpost that the Israelites had to put so that God would pass over and not kill the firstborn in that house. We'll talk more about the meaning of that next week. But for now, just note that this death of this lamb is pointing forward to the death of Jesus on the cross for the sins of all who would believe. In the previous plagues, we mentioned God had distinguished between the Israelites and the Egyptians without the Israelites doing anything. Here, the requirement is for the Israelites to put the blood on the door if they are not going to be killed. Why? Why did they have to do this? Why didn't God just do what He did in the earlier plagues? In the land of Goshen, no plague. Amongst the Egyptians, plague. He could have done it that way, but He didn't. Why? God is picturing something very important here. That He provides a way to save your life. God chose the Israelites as an ethnic group through whom He would provide redemption, to whom He would display His character, to whom He would entrust His law, His ordinances, His revelation of His character. But He did not choose every individual Israelite as His for all eternity. God provides a substitute for those who have faith in Him, for those who trust Him. God is under no obligation to provide a substitute for everyone who has a common ancestor. Nor is He under any obligation to provide a substitute for those who do certain acts. Instead, what He graciously decides is that He provides a substitute in the person of Jesus Christ for all those who come to Him by faith. And that is what the Israelites are exemplifying through putting the blood on the doorpost. They put the blood on the doorpost by faith. not as an act which is attempting to earn merit so that they deserve to have God pass over their house and not kill their child. Now, you might think, that seems like an act of obedience, right? God has said, put the blood on the doorpost. And so they do, and it's that act of obedience that saves their firstborn child. It is obedience, but it is the obedience that comes from faith. And it's very important to see that. That the firstborn child is not spared as a result of the parent's obedience. Nor is he spared apart from the parent's obedience. Let me say that again. The firstborn child is not spared as a result of the parent's obedience, nor is the child spared apart from the parent's obedience. Instead, that child is spared by God's grace through the parent's faith that results in their obedience. Okay? It's God's gracious act to spare this firstborn, which belongs to Him, whose life He would be perfectly just to take, but God graciously spares that life through the faith of the parents, and that faith is lived out, expressed through their putting the blood on the doorpost of the house. So for us, the analogy is our saving faith is a turning away from all attempts to establish our own merit. It's turning away from any sense that, because I've gone to church every Sunday for the last X weeks, therefore God is obligated to me. Or because I've put such and such percentage of my income into the offering, therefore God is obligated. Or because I've gone to Cameroon as a missionary, or because I've done X or done Y. Faith is turning away from all of that and looking only to God and His grace, and His Redeemer that He has chosen as the means for my redemption. And that's what is pictured in putting the blood on the doorposts. Saving faith always results in obedience. Jesus says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. But the obedience is not what saves. God's grace saves us through the faith that we have in His Redeemer. So God is sovereign over the beginning of life. He is sovereign over the end of life. He provides a way to save your life through faith in His Redeemer. And let me just say one brief word about this plundering of the Egyptians. If you want to mess up the outline I gave you, you could add a fourth subpoint. God provides for your saved life. The Israelites had lived in Egypt for 400 years. The last many decades of this, they had been slaves. They had lost what they had. They were not able to build up assets. They were being exploited by the Egyptians. And yet God was going to send them out into a desert land, into a wilderness for decades. And He was going to ask for contributions from them to build a tabernacle to His glory. It was going to require lots of gold and lots of various other elements. Where was all that going to come from? From an enslaved people. This is where it comes from. God makes the Egyptians so glad to get these people out. Because remember, they were saying, Egypt is ruined. Pharaoh, send them out. Don't you see? Egypt is ruined. They're so glad that these people are going to leave. They're hurrying them out. And they're saying, here, take this. They ask, and the people say, yeah, take this. Just go. Just go. Just go. Get out. They're trying to save their life. And so they're giving away all sorts of riches to the Israelites. Thus, God provides for the life of His people, and He provides for their worship so that they will be able to worship Him according to His explicit instructions. And just so with us. God provides for your saved life everything you need, says Peter, for life and godliness. Everything you need for the life that God intends for you to live, He provides. Well then, in conclusion, what would you do to save your life? I'm not sure I would have the fortitude to cut off my arm to save my life. But I think all of us would go to great lengths to save our lives. But we need to understand that our lives are in God's hands and not our own. We owe our very existence to Him. And the only reason that you don't die this second, that I don't die this second, is because of His mercy, His patience, His grace. So we need to see the God of the Exodus, the God of the plagues, as the one who holds all of our lives in His hands. And see that leaning on Him is the way to save our lives. That extraordinary lengths we may go to try to save our lives, maybe God will use those to make our life last a bit longer than it would have otherwise. But God is the one who's in control of all of those things. He is the one who holds our life and our death in His hands. So, when we serve a God like that, a God who provides for His people everything we need for life and godliness, what does that say about us when we worry? What does that say about us when we are anxious? What does that say about us when we are annoyed at the discouragements and the trials that come our way? If this is a God who holds all things in His hand, who has given you breath right now, then does it make any sense to worry? Does it make any sense to fear? Does it make any sense to get frantic about what might happen tomorrow? The point of this passage is for us to see the greatness of God, to understand that we're never going to understand Him, right? To come to the conclusion that this is a God so far beyond me, I can only know what He tells me. I can never control Him. I can never understand Him. And while that can be frustrating at times, because we're all control freaks in that sense, you wouldn't really want a God that you can control, right? If you could control God, so could people you don't like. And that wouldn't be any good. And you really wouldn't want a God that you could understand. Because if you could understand God, then He's not so great. How could someone you understand manage the entire universe? or bring into life new life. So the point of this passage is He is so great, the giver of life, the taker of life, and the one who provides a way to save your life. You can trust Him. You can rely on Him through Jesus Christ and through Him alone. He has told us how to be in relationship with Him. As we read from Acts, He commands all people everywhere to repent. And He's fixed a day on which He will judge the world in righteousness through this man, Jesus Christ. This is the Son who gives life to whom He will. This is the one who says, "The one who hears my word and believes Him who sent me has eternal life." This is the one we must love and trust and submit to. This is the one we must acknowledge. This is the one we must confess our sin to and say, "We deserve your judgment. We deserve to have that thread of our life broken and move into oblivion." This is the one in whom we must believe. That is our equivalent of putting the blood on the doorpost. That is our turning away from our attempts to establish our own righteousness and looking to Him for all of that righteousness. So do that. Turn to Him. Confess your anxieties. Confess your unbelief. Ask for a deeper faith, a deeper belief, and watch Him work. For your life and death are in His hands. So turn to Him for life. Let's pray together.